Trend number one, the new era in global consumption. In recent decades, consumers in the United States and other developed nations have not simply consumed, but overconsumed. From houses to automobiles to electronic gadgets, the trend was always to move up to increasingly expensive purchases and to leverage that activity by the use of credit, most recently enabled by rising home values. With the present economic crisis, however, a change has come, and we should not expect the future to look much like the past. As spelled out in a recent report from Citigroup Capital Markets titled Global Consumerism at the Crossroads, consumers in North America, the European Union, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand are no longer consuming the way they had done since the 90s. With respect to consumers in the developed world, the report offers four major takeaways. First, consumers are moving away from conspicuous consumption. Second, when they spend today, Western consumers are seeking out experiences more than possessions. Third, they are avoiding debt and saving more than they have in many decades. And fourth, they are lured by quality propositions rather than mere quantity. As we've explained before, and as Business Week recently confirmed, many American consumers are deleveraging by paying down debt, while others are getting substantial balances written off either through negotiation or bankruptcy. In February 2009, the U.S. saw the largest drop in consumer credit since 1972 on an annualized basis as balances on credit cards plummeted by $7.4 billion. This suggests a structural shift in the economy, one where consumers not only pay down revolving debt but weed out frivolous consumption. And reduced credit card limits by banks have reinforced that trend. Part of this change may be driven by the fact that consumers are now coming to grips with the so-called aspiration gap. The Citigroup report argues that as the income gap between the rich and the not-so-rich has widened, so has the difference between the lifestyles to which people have aspired and those they could afford. The recession has now forced many people to reassess their aspirations and become more realistic about what makes sense for them. In the long term, consumers in the developed world will become more thrifty than they have been during the last 30 years. But before we jump to conclusions, think back to the recession of 1990, when analysts last predicted a sea change in consumer habits. It didn't happen. So, just as $2 a gallon gas sank expectations for booming hybrid sales, those who try to extrapolate the present mood over the coming decade will be disappointed. The extreme frugality that some analysts expect will pass quickly as the economy recovers. In other words, we should not assume that consumption levels will remain depressed for an extended period. A great example of this is the automobile industry. Economist Brian Westbury recently made the case for a strong rebound in his report titled Bright Prospects for a Steep Auto Sector Recovery. He emphasized that automobile sales are now at unsustainably low rates, well below the volume required to replace the existing fleet as it inevitably wears out. So it's likely that both production and sales have hit bottom and will be rising sharply over the next 2 years. In another commentary, Westbury makes a similar case for a relatively healthy housing market beginning in 2010. First, housing is more affordable today than at any point since the early 70s. Second, based on current construction activity, replacement of America's housing stock would take 223 years, while the average lifespan of a new house is about 73 years. That means that with a growing population and older homes needing to be replaced, new housing starts will need to triple within a few years. Builders are just waiting for the excess inventory to be sold. In short, we're going to see plenty of cars and houses selling in coming years. The difference will be fewer huge homes as well as fewer Bentleys and Ferraris. This is symptomatic of a bigger trend. Western consumers are going to increasingly live within their means. That means we'll see strong growth as we return to sustainable levels of activity. This will then be followed by an upwardly sloping plateau. In a nutshell, if the world had to rely solely on North America and Europe to drive consumption, we'd be in for a challenging decade of slow growth, with most of that growth coming in categories sold disproportionately to older people. But fortunately, consumer demand is getting ready to take off in the developing world. As was pointed out recently by the World Bank, 93% of the middle class will live in developing nations by 2030, up from just 56% in 2000. During that period, roughly 800 million new people will be added to the middle class, That represents the equivalent of adding a city the size of New York to the global consumer market every 3 months. China and India will represent two-thirds of that growth. By 2030, there will be 1.15 billion people in the global middle class, up from just 430 million today. Therefore, for Western investors and managers, the big opportunities lie in global multinational corporations and their local competitors that can profitably serve this exploding demand. At the same time, economies of scale, revolutionary products, and new business models created to serve these markets will dramatically reduce costs for Western consumers. East Asia, including South Korea, Taiwan, and China, are the growth engines for the short term. However, demography implies that India and Pakistan will become central by mid-century. By 2015, according to Citigroup analysts, the global middle-class population will be divided about equally between an upper-middle-income segment making $10,000 to $20,000 per year and a lower-middle-income segment making $3,000 to $10,000 per year. To address the lower income segment in particular, marketers will have to create innovative products and business models that fit those budgets. That means tailoring products and businesses to meet the specific needs of each major market, as we'll discuss in our analysis of the trend, how trickle-up innovations will change the world. So what does this mean for specific markets and industries? We offer the following 10 forecasts for your consideration. First, consumption growth in the developed world will return, but at a slower pace. It will be focused less on luxury goods and more on experiences. It will be based less on credit and more on savings. People will value quality over quantity. Spirituality will become much more important. Businesses will have to earn back the trust of consumers and investors after some disappointments in recent years. People are still going to be wary of government, and there will be a strong backlash against heavy-handed government intervention in the private sector. Second, as people in the developing world become more affluent, food expenses will consume a smaller percentage of income. But the absolute dollar expenditure on foods will grow as people trade up to more expensive foods. High-protein items, such as meat, will replace high-carbohydrate foods like rice and beans. At the same time, there will be a growing market for snacks and convenience foods. The key to business success in this area will be to re-engineer convenience and fast foods to suit local tastes. Increasingly, agriculture in East Asia is not competitive with agribusiness in North America, South America, and Australia. That means that East Asia will become a food importer, opening vast business opportunities. Third, healthcare consumption will grow strongly in the developing world over the next 20 years, but it will begin from a remarkably low starting point. For example, pharmaceutical manufacturing is highly fragmented, and a lack of adequate property rights makes most of the developing world problematic for multinational drug firms. The brain drain of medical talent has been particularly strong in South Asia, where many physicians train abroad and never return. Meanwhile, China suffers from serious problems of quality among its physicians. For these reasons, healthcare opportunities in the developing world remain unclear. A big question is precisely what role private enterprise will play and what role government will play. For instance, despite its central planning heritage, China has never offered much in the way of a social safety net for its people. Fourth, a huge return will accrue to those who can modernize the retail business in the developing world. Consumers there tend to be served by highly fragmented retail channels. Large-scale retailers like Walmart could theoretically transform the supply chain in countries like India and China with enormous benefits for both themselves and consumers. However, early experience is teaching these companies that they have to re-engineer their business processes to satisfy local needs while retaining their operational effectiveness. Fifth, as the number of middle-class consumers grows, so inevitably will the demand for housing. While construction is essentially a local business, many raw materials tend to come from the Americas and Australia. More importantly, housing tends to drive demand for lots of other items like appliances, furniture, and textiles. This has strong implications for trade with Asia. It also creates a huge opportunity for financial services related to first and second mortgages and property insurance. Sixth, clothing, like food, will decline as a percentage of spending as wealth increases. But the quality of clothing will also increase. Since East and South Asia are centers for apparel and housewares manufacturing, this is a place where growing domestic demand will be served largely by local production. While budget apparel is still the dominant segment, data indicate that mid-priced clothing represents a significant prospect in the years ahead. Seventh, just as South Korea and Japan became major automotive centers in the second half of the 20th century, China and India will do so in the first half of the 21st. Ultra-inexpensive cars, like the $2,000 Tata Nano, are already opening up automobile ownership to a wider range of people. At the same time, China and India are moving rapidly to expand the capacity of their roads. One of the biggest opportunities related to automobile sales is consumer credit. Today, only a few percent of Chinese or Indians have access to credit for big-ticket items like cars. Auto insurance will create another booming business. Eighth, consumer telecom, as well as computing hardware and services, will continue to be among the most exciting businesses in the developing world. For example, China has 634 million cell phone subscribers out of 1.3 billion people. Today, Nokia is the leader in China's cell phone industry, and this is one industry in which local firms have struggled to keep up with multinationals. As netbooks replace PCs and cell phones, China will become increasingly wired. The biggest impediment in China is likely to be censorship, which we discussed in Trends several years ago. Therefore, electronic communications is apt to be one of the first areas where India surpasses China. Ninth, domestic and global tourism almost inevitably will rise more sharply than incomes. Unlike Egypt or Israel, East Asian countries will benefit mostly from regional tourism and from their citizens traveling abroad. Airlines that serve Asia are likely to be major beneficiaries, along with tourist destinations in Japan, Europe, and North America. And tenth, beyond all this, those companies that can profitably serve the 2 billion people who lie below the $3,000 per year cutoff for middle-class consumption will position themselves for long-term preeminence. C.K. Prahalad has made the case that there is enormous opportunity to create disruptive businesses aimed at the poorest consumers, which can then migrate upward. Some of the best opportunities may lie at the intersection of philanthropy and revolutionary technologies like nanotech, biotech, and infotech. Even where consumers remain too poor to be served directly by consumer products companies, foundations and aid agencies are prepared to fund water treatment programs, education initiatives, and nutrition programs that can improve productivity by orders of magnitude using those revolutionary technologies.